This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Today, the Pentagon said Alabama, Florida, and Mississippi requested National Guard troops to help oil cleanup efforts along the Gulf Coast. Louisiana already put in a request. Hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil continue to spill every day into the Gulf of Mexico from the collapsed Deepwater Horizon rig. And BP, which operates the rig, says capping the leak will take a couple of weeks at best, months at worst. As people in Gulf states wait for the oil to hit shore, dead animals have been washing up at the southern end of the Mississippi River. Thousands of miles of federal fishing areas have been closed, and thousands of people who rely on the Gulf Coast for their livelihood fear the worst. Later in the hour, the political implications of the oil spill on the opinion page. But first, we go to the Gulf Coast. If you're feeling the effects of the oil spill, give us a call. We especially want to hear from listeners along the Gulf Coast, in New Orleans or Fort Myers or other places. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. We begin with NPR's Debbie Elliott, who joins us from her home in Alabama. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you.
Has oil hit shore yet?
Not yet here. I think folks are still in the getting ready and preparing mode. I'm right along the Alabama-Florida line between Pensacola, Florida, and Mobile, Alabama, in a town called Orange Beach. And people here are you know, there's anxiety and uncertainty. It's like you know something's coming, you're not sure what, and people are doing everything they can to get ready to help protect sensitive beaches and estuary areas. Well, booms have been put out, things like that.
What can you do? It's not like, you know, when a hurricane's approaching and you can close up the windows and evacuate.
Right. And it's really interesting because a lot of people have sort of made that analogy. With a hurricane, you kind of have an idea when it's going to come. You kind of have an idea where it's going to come, and you know exactly what to do. You board up and you get out, and you know when you come back it might be hard, but the storm will have passed, and you can start to rebuild and regroup and figure out what's next. I think with the uncertainty of this, you know, how much is going to come ashore? Where is it going to go to shore? What is it going to look like? Is it going to be tar balls? Is it going to be a big sheen of oil that washes up on the beach? Nobody really knows, and officials are having a hard time giving answers because this is unprecedented. And as you mentioned, there's no end in sight. Right now, the oil is still coming from the ocean floor. BP is trying everything it can to stop it. It has not been successful. And until something happens that stops the flow, more and more is going into the ocean. So the impact could be weeks or, as you said, up to 3 months.
And what is BP doing? What's the latest?
You know, there are a lot of things they're doing. First of all, they're trying to fix what caused the problem in the first place, this blowout preventer that did not work when the rig accident happened. It did not shut off the supply of oil as intended. It's an emergency device, and it was supposed to close things off when things went wrong. It malfunctioned, did not work. There's an investigation underway as to why, and NPR's science reporter Richard Harris will be reporting on that this afternoon on All Things Considered. But so they're trying with remote devices to figure out what is going on with that and to close it off. Meanwhile, there are three breaches in what's known as the riser. That is the pipe that goes from the well up to the rig. Well, it's collapsed and on the ocean floor now, and it has three places where oil is coming out. BP is trying to cap one of those that is considered, I guess, the smallest place where there's less oil coming out. They're trying to cap that off and close it off so that they only have two to deal with. So that's one thing that they're doing. They're also building a device that they can put over those breaches. Like some have described it as a dome, others have described it as a box. It would go down and capture the oil coming out, and then oil would be siphoned off of that up to the surface. You know, we're talking like a mile here, and go on to tankers, and that oil would be taken away. The third thing they're doing is drilling a relief well, a parallel well, so that the oil comes out of that instead of the places where it's now gushing.
Now, BP has said they will pay for the cleanup. So, what is the role for, say, the Coast Guard or the Army Corps of Engineers?
Well, right now, I think federal officials are also throwing resources at it because it's coming, and BP has not been able to stop it. You know, BP tried to burn some of the oil last week, and it worked, but the weather conditions have not been such that they've been able to do that again. They've tried spraying dispersants. They've tried skimming the oil off the surface, and they've had some success on the days when the weather is good. But the past few days, the weather has just been terrible. The seas are rough. There's a lot of wind, and those efforts just you can't do that. In fact, just this morning, I was at Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida, where two Coast Guard cutters were readying to go out and start siphoning oil from the site, the accident site, where the heaviest oil slicks are. And they couldn't go out. You know, they're getting their equipment ready, but they're hoping they can go out later today or tomorrow, but they're not sure because the seas are rough, and the winds are high. So there's no way to, you can't get out there and do that work. Meanwhile, the slick is getting bigger and it is moving closer and closer to shore. There's been some impact on the Louisiana coast. People, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida are sort of just bracing. There have been no signs yet of it coming ashore.
And do you get a sense that people are just sort of frustrated and anxious, or are there things they can actually do to help with the cleanup or help direct it away from shore?
I think a little bit of all of that. There's definitely an anxiety level. This weekend we went out to the beach with our family, and a lot of people had come to the beach. It was like, well, this might be the last time. People had traveled, people who lived here, everybody was sort of out watching, looking, walking in the sand, building sandcastles, doing the things that people normally do all summer, worried this is the last time. They were going to local seafood restaurants to eat shrimp and local fish because there is no fishing in the Gulf of Mexico anymore. NOAA has closed that off. So now those fishermen, both the recreational fishermen and the commercial fishermen, the people, who collect oysters, the shrimpers, nobody is working, and they're frustrated. They want to help. They say they know these waters better than anybody. BP has agreed to hire some of them to do some of this preparation work and training them actually in hazmat so that they can participate in the cleanup. There's been some controversy there, though. Originally, the contracts that BP was offering, fishermen had some language in it that some perceived as if you go to work for us, you're giving up your right to sue us for damages later. That didn't sit well with fishermen. BP says now it's leaving that language out of the contracts. Alabama's attorney general told them not even to distribute such contracts in his state anymore. So, people are showing up at meetings where BP officials are there and trying to tell them what they're doing, but there's just this growing sense of frustration that not enough is being done. There's so much uncertainty. We don't know, what's going to happen to our livelihood. We don't know if businesses who rely on tourism, who rely on fishing, and that's a lot of businesses all along this coast, stretching from South Louisiana all the way to the Florida Keys. They're just, waiting, wondering what's going to happen.
Debbie Elliott is a national correspondent for NPR. She joined us from her home in Alabama. Thanks so much, Debbie.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And now, to get a perspective from a shrimper, we turn to Kim Chauvin. She is co-owner of Mariah Jade Shrimp Company in Houma, Louisiana, and she joins us from her office. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing? One of the comments that I really want to make is that not all of the federal waters are closed. The spill has affected on the eastern side of Louisiana and moved east into Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida waters. So those federal waters are closed off. Our state officials and federal officials are testing water samples in the central part of Louisiana and in the western part of Louisiana on the, in the water. So there are oyster fishermen working, there are crab fishermen working, there are shrimp fishermen working. We do have inventory that we've worked all winter long for, and they are still catching in this part in time. Our Louisiana seafood is still good. What we'll do is no fisherman, no processor, and no dock owner wants to sell anything that would be affected by the spill. So we have called in our agencies to make sure. So, yes, on the eastern part of Louisiana, yes, it is closed down. Central and Western, we have not been affected at this point in time, and pray hard that we will not be affected. But there are fishermen that are working. So, I don't want the confusion to be that if this oil spill doesn't do it for us, then, you know, in the media outlet, we need to be very, very clear on what is open and what is not, and what is good and what is not. And in central and western parts, our seafood is very good.
And are all your boats out able to shrimp?
Our boats are able to shrimp. We've taken it, and we've gone on to the oil spill because we want to make sure that, or at least have a hand in trying to make sure that it doesn't come to our estuaries. We know the importance of going out there and, you know, scooping this up and picking it up as much as we possibly can to where it does not affect our estuaries.
So,
I mean, our prayer is that they get this contained.
Can you explain how a shrimp boat can help clean up oil?
BP, as far as I know, is hiring shrimp vessels, and the booms that sit up high in the air actually go out, like if you put your arms straight across, both arms, and then they'll have, they have these other orange booms that there's what's called a sock fits on top of it, and no, it's not like your regular sock, but it does hold a lot of oil, and so what it does is it skims along the top, picks up the oil. These guys are in hazmat clothing, and then will therefore, you know, pick this up, throw it in the garbage. It'll go into a separate barge, which will contain all of that. So they know the importance of getting out there and getting this done, because nobody wants it coming this way.
And what's the best case scenario for you? What are you hoping for?
One, of course, our prayers are that they would contain this and that we can get this cleaned up as quickly as possible. And yes, I know that this is major, and our coastlines are vast, so we have a lot of cleanup to deal with on this port. Our best case scenario is that they cap it off now, the winds don't flow this way, and that we're able to get boats out from Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Louisiana, Texas, and get this cleaned up as quickly.
Kim Chauvin is co-owner of Mariah Jade Shrimp Company south of Houma, Louisiana. She joined us on the line from her office there. We'll talk more about the effects of the oil leak on the Gulf Coast in a moment and talk with an oceanographer about the cleanup efforts. Stay with us. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Scientists now say the oil leak that started in the Gulf of Mexico will likely spread to the Florida Keys in the coming days and, depending on currents, could send oil up the East Coast. We'll talk more about the cleanup and where the oil's headed in a moment. The Gulf Coast is also home to the second largest seafood industry in the country, second only to Alaska. The area accounts for the bulk of U.S. production of oysters and shrimp, and many of the fishermen are bracing for the worst. If you're feeling the effects of this oil spill, give us a call. We especially want to hear from listeners along the Gulf Coast in New Orleans or Fort Myers or other areas. The number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. With me now is Ian McDonald. He's a professor of oceanography at Florida State University. He joins us on the line from Florida. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
First, just help us understand the language of this oil spill. We're hearing oil slick. We're talking about oil sheen. What is the difference and which is more accurate?
Well, we're talking about very thin layers of oil that are floating on the surface of the ocean, having come up from 5,000 feet down and spread up from a fairly small area out to cover what is now a huge expanse. So, you know, there are millions of gallons of oil out there, but they're covering thousands of square miles. So the layers are very thin, but the sizes are very large. And as the waves and the currents and the winds push this oil around, some of it gets thinner and some of it bunches up into thicker portions. Of course, where it's reaching the surface, that's where some of the thickest oil is. And where it's about to go ashore, it tends to concentrate again and become thicker. So it's a really elastic, large, moving layer. And tracking it, quantifying it is very challenging.
And is the strategy for containing it or cleaning it up different depending on how that quantification turns out?
Well, it is. What the responders are trying to do, of course, is to focus where the oil is thickest, so that the efforts that go ahead with skimming and absorbing, the way the previous caller discussed, so they can be most effective. But we don't always know where it's thickest, and so that's where satellite and aerial surveillance can be very helpful.
And do you have any sense of when and where it might hit land?
Well, the forecast is that it may hold off for a day or two more. That is the main portion we've come across, and it probably will be going north and east, but it's a very inexact science, and we're not certain what will be happening. What is certain is that it's not going to stay out there forever and that it will start coming ashore in the days and weeks to come. We hope that they cap the spill soon, but even if they capped it tomorrow, we would still have to deal eventually with the large volume of oil that's currently floating offshore.
We have an email from Homero in Sacramento who says, does the fact that oil and water don't mix make a difference when it comes to cleaning up the oil from the sea?
Absolutely, and we take advantage of that in one sense, in that the skimmers and the cleanup effort are operating on this very thin layer. And when I say thin, I'm talking about layers that, even for thick oil, are no greater than the thickness of a human hair if you average them out over these large areas. So the skimmers and the responders have this enormous challenge of trying to sweep up the oil over these very large areas. And so, you know, even with the best effort and the most proficient technical approach, it is very challenging, particularly now that the spill has been ongoing for so many days.
So if it's this very thin layer at the surface, does that mean animals and plant life deeper down are protected?
Well, to some extent, but of course some animals, like marine mammals, have to come through that surface layer. So whales and birds are particularly affected. And then, of course, a number of things happen as oil stays out at sea. Lately, we've had some periods of rough weather offshore. The waves have been 6 to 8 feet. The winds have been blowing 20 knots or so, and it's made it very difficult for the skimmers to operate. In one sense, it's probably been good because it tends to break the oil down, mix it up, and concentrate it. Some of the oil breaks down and sinks or is actually absorbed by the water. But the oil that's left forms an emulsion, sort of a mayonnaise, or they actually call it mousse, oil mousse. And that's a mixture of oil and water that has a greater volume, actually, than oil itself, is kind of gelatinous and sticky. And that poses a real challenge for the cleanup and a real hazard for animals.
And so that oil mousse is what is formed after a little while of churning around and agitating with the seawater?
That's right. That's one of the first things that happens is the oil forms an emulsion, and then eventually the emulsion starts to form tar balls. And the tar balls are what are familiar to people, or unfortunately, in some of the Gulf region, as washing ashore and getting on your feet. But these large emulsion layers, these large oil mousses, they're a much more formidable and much more hazardous substance.
Let's take a call from Jim in Kansas City. Jim, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, welcome. I love your show. Could I ask a question, being an upstream from the Delta, would any additional releases from the reservoirs up north on the Missouri River or the Minnesota help keep the oil at bay away from the Delta?
I doubt it. I mean, I don't want to totally rule that out. I haven't considered that, and I don't know that the responders have considered that. I know one concern that they have is that as ships, this is a major shipping channel, of course, New Orleans is a major port, and as ships drive through this very large spill and they can't really go around it, when they come up the river, their hulls will be coated to some extent with oil. And so, you know, one of the problems is moving that, you know, booming these ships off and making sure that they clean up the ships themselves, because they don't want to intensify the economic impact by closing down the port. So to some degree, the flow in the Mississippi River may impact that process.
Let's hear from Amanda in Tallahassee. Amanda, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks. That's great to be on.
Sure.
I just want to say my husband and I are going to be renting a house in Panacea, Florida, which is in Wakulla County. We currently live in Tallahassee. And it's off of Dickerson Bay, but it's, you know, off the Gulf. And we're both just absolutely terrified. We've been in complete mourning for the past, you know, week. I'm actually a volunteer with SOS Florida, Save Our Shores. And we're just really, you know, it's been stressful. It's been personally stressful, but we've decided that sitting around feeling bad about it is not going to change anything. You know, sitting at home feeling upset about the loss of marine wildlife, and of course there's a human tragedy to the spill. You know, people, the fisheries, the oyster fisheries, but we're actually going to be doing some cleanup, and we're working with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission to see if we can help relocate some of these animals before they're actually affected by the spill. And, I mean, the logistics of that are still being worked out. But I wanted to tell people that if they want to get involved with our sort of grassroots effort to fix this problem, they can find us on our Facebook group, Save Our Shores Florida. And we're really trying to make something positive happen out of this. I mean, it is a tragedy, but we're beginning to understand that there is a potential to make sure this never happens again.
Amanda, thank you so much for your call. You know, we hear from Amanda, we heard earlier from Debbie Elliott, this sort of anxiety of waiting for the spill to come to shore and not really knowing what you're dealing with until or unless it hits your beach. What is the strategy once oil makes landfall? How do you clean it up when it starts washing up?
That's very challenging. There's a couple of strategies. They can put out mats and what are called pom-poms, and these are also oil-absorbent materials, and they can be spread out along the shoreline. And
did you say pom-poms?
Pom-poms, yeah. They actually resemble the sort of cheerleader pom-poms, and they have sort of stringy bits of this oil-absorbing material, and they put those out on ropes. So I mean, they're like the boom system, except they're meant to absorb the oil, not just block it. And they're put out, and the oil washes into them, and a lot of that oil is absorbed, and it can be cleaned up. I want to sympathize and concur with the previous caller. The coastal zone is some of the most precious territory on Earth. It's precious for its economic importance, the value of its seafood, the value of the real estate, the hotels, the homes. It's also precious for, you know, the societal value, the cultural value. You know, the coastline is deeply important, I think, to all people. But it also has this great economic value, ecological value that's over and above its economic value. We depend on this functioning ecosystem of the coastline here in the Gulf Coast for our livelihoods, for our societal well-being, but then the whole Gulf ecosystem depends on estuaries, which are able to nurture the young of shellfish and fish. The estuaries clean the waters that come down from our runoff and help keep the bay clean or the oceans clean. The coastal fisheries depend on this, and any impact of oil is going to diminish that value, the economic value and also the ecological value. And I think as we begin to cope with this, there's going to be grief and anger. But what there needs to be right now is resolve to do the best we can to deal with this situation and to everybody step up the way the previous caller suggested. And I think there will be opportunities throughout the Gulf region for people to do just that.
You mentioned aerial photography looking down on the spill. You mentioned these absorbent pom-poms on the beach. It sounds, frankly, not the most high-tech treatment. I mean, how good is the technology? How much investment is there in cleaning up and determining the extent of oil spills?
The technology got a big bump after Exxon Valdez, but then we've gone through a lot of years where there hasn't been a major problem, and also a lot of the focus for the Coast Guard has shifted to anti-terrorism activities, and so some of the resources have been directed away from oil spill response, and they're now being directed back as quickly as possible. But you're right, it is a very low-tech process, and that does allow volunteers to play an important role. You know, a lot of the tracking and the modeling, that is probably more sophisticated than it was before. There are a lot of oil spill models that can predict where this stuff is going to come ashore, and that can be vital, in concentrating these low-tech interventions where they'll do the most good. And then also, to the extent that we can prevent oil from coming ashore or boom it off or absorb it before it hits the seabird nests and the turtle nests and so forth, prediction and modeling can be a key tool in that. So some sophisticated mathematical models and marine forecasting, coupled with plain old hard work and low-tech methods, I think is what's going to have to carry us forward.
Ian McDonald is professor of oceanography at Florida State University. He joined us on the line from Florida. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We are talking about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, where it's going, and efforts to try to avert the worst of an ecological and economic disaster. You can join us at 800-989-8255, or you can send us email, talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. With us now is John Besh. He's executive chef and owner of Besh Restaurant Group. He joins us on the line from Lincoln Center in New York City. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. So you are in New York City right now, but your restaurants are in New Orleans. How is this affecting your business?
Well, it's with a heavy heart that, one, we have this conversation, because it just seems like yesterday that we were dealt the blow of Hurricane Katrina and the cleanup and rebuilding effort, which soon ensued after that, and now we're dealt this card. And I'm actually here for the James Beard Foundation, and this is the night of the annual Chef's Award ceremony. So it's with mixed emotion because I'm very proud to be here. But, you know, things back home are, you know, we're at this critical state where it is really, it greatly depends, our future really depends on getting this thing, alleviating, one, this gush of oil into the Gulf of Mexico, and two, really concentrating efforts and marshaling resources to combat or mitigate the effects of this spill.
Well, it seems like, you know, there are concerns for someone like you on a lot of levels. Obviously, you want tourists to come to New Orleans and keep your restaurant successful. You want your suppliers to continue to be able to earn a livelihood, and also you've championed, you know, locally sourced products in the Gulf, so you're not going to be the first person who says, oh, I'll just use Chinese shrimp instead.
Right, and, you know, that's been a very unfortunate card that's been dealt to our shrimpers so far, and to a lot of our fishermen, that this, you know, rampant importation of just sub-quality product coming from waters that are, you know, who knows where, fed who knows what. You know, these are working people, men and women, families that have been hard at work here for hundreds of years. These coastal communities depend on, you know, this delicate resource, those marsh grasses. It's more than just about the turtle. And the turtle's very important. There's a fragile ecosystem that we've been in danger of losing for years. At risk here. And, you know, this is over two-thirds of the seafood produced in the lower 48. We produce two-thirds of that seafood out of those marshlands, out of those grass beds and those estuaries that lead into the Gulf of Mexico. Without those, you know, that's fed our country for years. And so without those coastal communities and that we're in big trouble. This is something that no natural disaster could ever bring upon us. Yeah, you know, you can bounce back from those fairly easily.
Well, but you know, you mentioned Katrina, which was not easy to bounce back from. But you know, New Orleans has had a pretty good season. The Saints won. You inaugurated a new mayor today. You know, it sort of felt like things were coming back. Do you think this really knocks New Orleans back?
It's amazing what five years can make a huge difference. And, you know, though we are American and we want things, you know, we want instantaneous success, you know, relatively short amount of time, you can bounce back after floods and things of that nature. You know, we have never seen a spill to this magnitude. And so we don't even know, you know, the technologies haven't even been created yet to even approach something of this magnitude. And so a lot of what we have now are just a lot of speculation, and we hope and we pray, and, you know, Lord knows we're going to get at it. I think one of the frustrating things has been it took about 10 days before we had a real direct response from the federal government that, you know, of what their role is going to be in the management of this crisis. Because I don't think people fully appreciated the crisis here that is, you know, the things that are at stake. It's more than just the pristine grasslands that empty into the Gulf of Mexico.
We have to leave it there. John Besh is executive chef, owner of the Besh Restaurant Group. He joined us from Lincoln Center in New York City, where he was for the James Beard Awards. Coming up on the opinion page, the political fallout of the oil spill. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.